G'day everyone. Hope you're having a good morning. Okay, so what kind of leader do you like to vote for? What kind of person do you think should be given the authority? Authority is a key theme in today's passage. In today's passage, we see the authority of Jesus put into practice. We see Jesus teaching with authority, casting out demons with authority, healing with authority. And we see reactions to that authority. Reactions from synagogue members, reactions from demons, the crowds, a leper. All reactions to Jesus' authority. So today, we'll sort of talk about Jesus' displays of authority and the reactions. So we'll go through his teaching, talk a bit about demons, a bit about the leper, and then we'll finish with the crowds and finally Jesus' withdrawal from the crowds. So let's start with the first example of Jesus' authority, the teaching. Verse 21. And they went into Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath he entered the synagogue and was teaching. And they were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one who had authority and not as the scribes. Jesus taught with authority. Jesus didn't need to say, Rabbi so-and-so said this, or prophet so-and-so says that. The scribes might base their teachings on the great rabbis, and great rabbis might base their teaching on the prophets, and even the prophets based their teaching on what they heard directly from the Lord. Even I base my teaching on other scholars. I'm not a prophet, I'm already even an ordained minister, so it's appropriate for me to base what I say on those with better understanding and higher authority. But Jesus didn't base his teachings on any of these things. He might refer to prophets from time to time, but for the most part, he just taught as though his teachings were all his own. Not even the prophets did that. Even the prophets claimed to be conveying a message from God rather than from themselves. They used the phrase, "Thus says the Lord." But Jesus didn't even use that phrase. Jesus spoke almost as if he were the Lord. And so, the people were astonished by this display of authority. The Greek word for astonished conveys a bit of fear. The authority that Jesus spoke with was so astonishing that it made the people a bit afraid. And they're not the only ones. Something in the crowd reacts with fear too, an unclean spirit, a demon. Verse 23. And immediately there was in the synagogue a man with an unclean spirit. And he cried out, "What have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." A demon recognizes Jesus and is fearful of his authority. But before we deal with the demon's reaction, let's talk about the idea of demons themselves. A lot of Western people, and even Western Christians, are not really sure what to do with the idea of demons. And I'm still learning myself. The idea of demons seems a bit outdated in our scientific age. We might hear of Christians with overactive imaginations who see the demonic around every corner. Or worse, we hear cautionary tales of well-meaning Christians who mistook mental illness for demon possession. So some people are, perhaps understandably, a bit offended by the idea of demons. Although I do know people who might well have experienced a manifestation of the demonic, I personally never have. So I can't claim much authority in this area. But if we're to take the gospel stories seriously, we need to take demons seriously. Casting out demons was one of Jesus' main activities. Outside the Western world, casting out demons is still a common part of the ministry of many churches. Outside the Western world, accounts of demon possession are not so uncommon. I'm not sure what to do with that yet. I have no personal experience of seeing demons manifesting, but some people pretty close to me have. Were these experiences supernatural, psychological, a bit of both? I don't know. But as a Christian, I do have to take the idea of demons seriously. But not too seriously. As C.S. Lewis says in Screwtape Letters, we shouldn't go to the extreme of just accepting every claim about demons we hear. We shouldn't give them too much attention. But at the same time, Lewis also cautioned against going to the other extreme and just denying the existence of the demonic or ignoring it altogether. We can't put it all down to mental illness. Jesus wasn't casting mental illness into a herd of pigs. We don't see much demonic activity in the Old Testament, but the New Testament world seems infested with them. Why? I can only speculate. Had the demons concentrated themselves in Israel, awaiting their confrontation with the Messiah? Or was there something limiting the activity of demons in Old Testament times in Israel? Or is it just coincidence that there are fewer stories about demons in the Old Testament? I don't know. It's interesting that the people were so amazed that Jesus had authority to command demons. That when Jesus told the demons what to do, they actually obeyed. Their amazement suggests that this didn't usually happen. The New Testament writers don't seem to feel the need to explain why there were so many demons floating around at the time. They just assume everyone would know what demons were. They assumed that people would know that demons could possess people. But they didn't assume that they could be easily cast out. The Jews had various protocols for attempting to cast out a demon. And I'm sure Jesus wasn't the first to attempt to exorcise a demon. The people are not surprised that Jesus attempted to cast out demons. They were surprised that he was successful, and with nothing but a command. This suggests that successful exorcisms might have been rare back then. It also speaks to Jesus' authority. The demons are essentially fallen angels. Angels are higher than humans in the cosmological pecking order, even fallen angels. Angels don't obey humans, but they obey Jesus. What kind of man was this? So now that we've addressed the idea of demons a little bit, let's turn back to the reaction of the demon in today's passage. When the demon first sees Jesus, it reacts by asking, "What have you to do with us? Have you come to destroy us?" Now the scripture said that at the end of time, God would destroy his enemies. And the Jews and perhaps the demons had gotten the idea that the Messiah would also come at the end of time. Now, we now know that the Messiah came in the middle of time, somewhere in the middle of time, but they didn't know that. So if Jesus was the Messiah, then from their perspective, perhaps the end of time had come and God was about to destroy the demons. So I guess the demon asked the question that all demons wanted to know. Had Jesus come to destroy them? But before waiting for an answer, it then claimed to know who Jesus was. The Holy One of God. But why would it tell everyone who Jesus was? On the surface, you might think that that would help Jesus' cause. It would give him publicity. So what was motivating the demon to publicize the identity of Jesus? Bottom line is, we don't really know, but we have some theories. Some scholars say that the peoples of the ancient Near East thought that if you could get some kind of power over someone, if you knew their identity. And the demon was trying to get power over Jesus. While this is certainly possible, I have another theory. My theory is that the demon was trying to deceive people about the type of Messiah that Jesus was going to be. The demon called Jesus the Holy One of God. Now, when you hear that in English, it just sounds like a generic person from God. Nothing particularly special. But according to R.C. Sproul, the only other place in the Bible that this phrase is used is for Samson, the warrior. Now, I could be wrong about this, but my best guess is that the demon was trying to suggest that Jesus was going to be a warrior-like Messiah, like Samson. Samson was a warrior who killed the human enemies of Israel. This is the kind of Messiah that people wanted, and the demon knew it. A mighty warrior who would punish their enemies and improve their earthly lives. A Samson-type Messiah would bring vengeance and comfort for the people of Israel. But that's not the kind of Messiah that Jesus was. Jesus had not actually told anyone that he was the Messiah at that point. The Jews already had all kinds of wrong ideas of what the Messiah would be. So Jesus planned not to tell them that he was the Messiah until he had told them what kind of Messiah that he would be. Before Jesus went public with his status, he wanted first to establish what he stood for, and he wanted to do this by his teaching. So, at the beginning of his ministry, he kept his messianic identity a secret. Some think he kept this secret for other reasons too, but I don't have time to go into those today. So, Jesus told the demon to stay silent. And my guess is that Jesus' plan was to keep his messiahship a secret. Was probably why he told the leper to stay silent as well. Jesus didn't want people to follow him for his healing power alone. He wanted to explain what his values were, what kind of kingdom he was announcing, so that when he did reveal his messianic identity, people would know what kind of Messiah he would be. My guess is that the demons wanted to frustrate that plan. Maybe that's why they manifested when they recognized Jesus instead of staying hidden. So, Jesus tells the demon in no uncertain terms to stay silent, the same way he told the leper to stay silent. The Greek is very stern in both cases. But in the case of the leper, it's also slightly ambiguous. We know that Jesus warned him very sternly about something. There is some disagreement amongst commentators that I've read as to whether Jesus is sternly warning him to stay silent, the leper that is, or sternly warning him not to sin again, with the assumption that the leper's leprosy was a result of some sin that he'd committed in the past. I prefer that Jesus was warning him to stay silent. But if that's the case, it seems to me we have to treat the warning as a pretty strict command. The type of warning that Jesus gave to the demon. Now the demon seems to have no choice but to obey. The leper is also given the command, but seems to have the choice to disobey. And disobey he did. Just like the demon, the leper was prepared to disobey Jesus for his own interests. Why? My guess is that he wanted to feel the comfort of human society as soon as possible. The leper wanted to reintegrate into society as soon as possible. But for that, he had to prove to them all that he was no longer unclean, and therefore he could be allowed back into society. My guess is that he told people about Jesus, not out of gratitude for Jesus, but out of a desire to be accepted back by society. Jesus was not uncaring about the leper's need to be accepted back. He knew that the leper would need to reintegrate, which is why Jesus told him to go and see the priests. In those days, the priests determined who was clean and who was unclean, who should quarantine and isolate and who shouldn't, especially when it came to leprosy. This was in obedience to the law as written in Leviticus 13 and 14. Jesus knew that the priests could inspect him and declare him clean so that he could lawfully mix with people again. Jesus didn't need to send everyone he healed to the priests because in many cases it was obvious that they'd been made clean. It doesn't take a priest to prove that a lame man can now walk. But leprosy is less obvious, and the requirements for the Torah, of the Torah for lepers to isolate are more stringent. So in the leper's case, it made sense to get the priest to help him to reintegrate back into society, to declare that he was now clean. So although Jesus wanted the leper to stay silent about how he was healed, he didn't expect the leper to stay separate from society or hide the fact that he was now clean. When we think about Jesus' miracles, we need to remember what they're symbolizing. They're a demonstration that the year of the Lord's favor has now come. That's where we are currently in God's calendar, the year of the Lord's favor. Whether he was casting out an unclean spirit or casting out an unclean disease, the point is that he's making people clean to symbolize God's offer of favor. The law gave a system of who should be declared clean or unclean. The point of the law was to remind the Jews that although they might be God's chosen race, they were still sinful. Ceremonial uncleanness was a reminder of spiritual uncleanness. Pretty much everyone in Israel would be ceremonially unclean at some point in their lives. Pretty much everyone experienced what it felt like to be declared unclean. But it was much harder on the diseased and demon-possessed. They spent much more time excluded from society. It was against the law to touch a person while they were ceremonially unclean. This may have been partly for hygiene reasons, but the social isolation from man was a reminder of spiritual isolation from God. The law was supposed to remind both the Jews and Gentiles of their uncleanness, that they were not sinless and still in need of grace. But Jesus had come to bring grace with an authority even above the law. When Jesus touched people, instead of their uncleanness passing to him, his cleanness passed to them. Jesus' touch healed them and made them ceremonially clean. His healing authority symbolized a deeper spiritual authority, the authority to make people spiritually clean. The Bible scholar Tom Wright, who I get a lot of this idea from, suggests that the spiritual authority of Jesus might have threatened the priests. The priests were supposed to regulate who was clean and unclean. In most cases, Jesus bypassed this system as if he were a new and superior type of priest. Jesus, and not the priest, had the true authority to make people clean. But not everyone saw the spiritual significance. For many, they just saw it as an opportunity to reintegrate into society. My guess is that the leper was keen to speed up the process of his own reintegration. If he told everyone that he'd been healed by a famous healer, they'd feel more comfortable around him. He was more interested in maximizing his own comfort than obeying Jesus. Note that a miracle from God did not change the leper's heart. Sometimes we think that if we just saw a miracle, we'd turn to Jesus. We flatter ourselves into thinking that we would live right if we knew for sure that it were all true. But living right is harder than it sounds. Miracles don't always change the heart. They don't always bring obedience. They do always bring accountability before God. I mean, once you know, you know. Much is expected of those to whom much is given. But miracles don't always bring obedience. But they do bring crowds. There are some accounts of miraculous healings in the Old Testament, but not so many. But in the New Testament, we see Jesus walking around healing people left, right, and centre. This drew crowds. I mean, I'd probably turn up to see it. Even secular historians would have to admit that Jesus was doing something to draw those crowds. The crowds who came to Jesus wanted their physical and social problems solved. But did they really want to reconnect with God? Or did they just want God to maximize their comfort, solve their earthly problems? They probably had all kinds of mixed motives, but Jesus knew that for many it was comfort and not connection that the crowds were really after. It's not that Jesus didn't care about their earthly problems. He dearly wanted to help people. When Jesus looked on the leper with compassion, the Greek word said there also suggests anger. So I remember in your translation it was indignant. Anger that the leper had to go through such suffering. I think Jesus was constantly torn between wanting to fix people's immediate problems on the one hand and knowing that in the long run he had to focus on an even more important problem. He had to win back their hearts. He had to create a way to reconnect with God for those who really did want that. My guess is that he was constantly torn between those two things. I think that's why he needed to retreat from people from time to time and refocus on his true mission. Verse 35. And rising very early in the morning, while it was still dark, he departed and went out to a desolate place, and there he prayed. And Simon and those who were with him searched for him. Everyone is looking for you. And he said to them, let us go on to the next towns that I may preach there also, for that is why I came. We can't fix everyone's problems. Not even Jesus tried to solve all the world's problems. He had to prioritize his mission. He knew he needed boundaries. And if Jesus needed boundaries, then so do we. If Jesus needed to take time out to sort out his priorities, then so do we. Jesus wanted to help people, but his highest priority at that stage was to preach. He didn't just come to fix our physical problems. He didn't just come to fix our social problems. He came to clean our hearts and give us purpose again. He came to overcome evil itself. The miracles were primarily to symbolize the message that he was preaching, to show that the message came with authority. So I guess the question for us is this: why do we come to Jesus? Comfort or reconnection? Are we only thinking about what he can do for us? Or are we also thinking about what we can be doing for him?